Hello and welcome back to a new episode of Brain Pops, the podcast approaching mental and physical challenges behind the scenes of professional sports. Today it's episode 57 and with me, as always, is Lennart Stechmann. Lennart, nice to see you, but this time I don't see you, but I hear you. That's good enough, I guess. How are you?
Hey Dom, I'm great, thank you. It's good to hear you again, and I see you too. We had a little bit of a longer break than actually planned, but I think we can say we're back with a bang.
I double on that. Why don't you let us know who is our guest today?
Yeah, our guest today is Coach Chris Oliver, and I came across him while after we talked to Alex Arama, which was one of my personal favorite episodes that we recorded in the past. And I got much more into the kind of the CLA and the practice that Alex introduced us to. And then of course I came across the platform basketballimmersion.com, and Chris Oliver is the founder. And he's sort of say an expert in basketball decision training, let's say. So he's been coaching himself, but he also consults now different organizations, I think from NBA, NCAA, high school to club basketball. And I think what stands out with him is that he wants to, of course, maximize players' potential, but also the enjoyment of practice itself and having fun. And this is something I really enjoyed, and I listened to his podcast, the basketball podcast, and I'm really grateful to have him on the show today and to get some brain pops as usual.
Exactly. And Alex Sarama is actually probably also his friend, but also his colleague, but that's probably something he can enlarge on once we get him on the show.
Yes. So, again, we will talk a lot about the role of the head coach today, practice itself, maybe some in-game stuff. I'm just looking forward to have a good, great conversation. So oh. I guess we can just get him on the show, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, Coach, thank you for being here today.
Hey, guys, great to be here. Awesome to be here, and great to follow Alex as well. I'm not sure if I'm as scientifically geeky as he is, but I try and hold it up the same. And really proud of Alex and all the work he's done and all the work he's done sharing the game.
And I mean, I said that already in the pre-show. How did you guys connect?
So Alex was a young coach working for NBA Europe, and I believe he was searching for a better way. He had a background in some of the skill acquisition, CLA, and the different things around kind of, is there a better way in terms of how we teach, especially around how we teach the game? And he connected with me because he attended a practice in Europe, a high-level practice, and he just wanted to kind of discuss it with me. And I guess for him, more or less confirm and find a community of people that were like-minded in him, that realized that blocked on-air practice, no defense, was not the most effective way to be able to coach and develop. And fortunately, by that time, I'd been running Basketball Immersion since 2014. So Alex was a member of our community, our membership community. And he reached out to just continue the conversation. And then from there, a relationship definitely developed. And I see Alex in me. I mean, I think about myself. I don't know how old you guys are, but I think about myself being young, not married, no kids, with the internet, and with just a desire to learn. And that's what Alex is, and it's absolutely remarkable. And certainly I'm envious of him and the amount of time and effort he puts into his learning, and it obviously serves all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And since you said Alex was looking for another way, I think that we can dive deeper into that, because my first question was, what made you realize that basketball coaching needs a change, let's say, if we talk about a different way, let's call it a change, and probably something also happened to you or made you realize that there's a different way?
So it's about 25 years ago now that I did a master's degree in education and coaching studies at the University of Victoria. And at that time, I was exposed to a number of skill acquisition and motor learning professors who really exposed me to things around simple ideas around random versus block practice, the reversal effect, these different types of scientific principles that, again, aren't new. They aren't new. I didn't invent them, but they connected with me because I knew from my basketball experience and I knew from the experiences I've had as an assistant and as head coach that I just knew there must be a better way to be able to learn how to play basketball. And by and large, from that point on, I followed this, whatever you want to call it, games approach, a little bit of mixed ecological dynamics, constraint-led approach, all these different approaches. And I coached that way. So I've coached that way for about 25 years. What I didn't realize is that everyone else wasn't doing that until I really started to travel and spend time with other coaches. And I took a sabbatical from the University of Windsor where I coached. I traveled around the world and I went to about 50 practices around the world, from the NBA to EuroLeague to different types of youth development areas. And I found that everyone by and large was doing memorized, scripted practice. So they're just basically memorizing what the coach said. They were regurgitating it and repeating it. And what I started to challenge people on in a really hopefully positive way was, basketball isn't a dance recital. It's not this scripted thing that, you know, we can follow. Since we can't script the game because it's chaotic by nature, then I guess the question is for you and all your audience, why do we spend so much time trying to script it? And we script so much in practice. Yeah. And that by scripting instead of teaching principles of play, we take away players' natural creativity and diminish their cognitive problem solving. And that to me is the biggest kind of downfall of kind of doing this blocked, memorize, regurgitate type of practice, this dance recital, is that you're taking away players' freedom and creativity. And thus, coming back to what you said, Leonard, that doesn't connect with them. Players don't want to do that. Players don't want to repeat the same thing over and over again. They want to play and they want to be able to express their skill in a creative and free way.
Yeah. And also, I also listened to a couple of episodes of your podcast. You are already a pro with like 260 episodes, I think. I didn't listen to them all, but a couple I got. And I think in your latest show, somebody said that this way of coaching that you just started to describe also fits his personal values a lot better, the way he thinks and wants to act. And that was also always a big point for me when I was thinking about coaching. Like, the longer coaches used to be a coach, I feel like sometimes they got stuck in their way or are very narrow down, and I feel like under pressure. And I always feel like because they expect something from themselves that they might really in actual life not value as much, actually. That just an idea I had in my head. Maybe you can do something with that.
Well, I guess the easiest way to approach what you just said is that if we all think about this, learning skills, whatever you define as skills, I would consider decisions a skill. So I think of that as all-encompassing word, not just biomechanical, but decision-making as well. But learning skills is not the process of repeating a solution. It is repeating the process of finding a solution. And to me, that's at the cornerstone of what you just said. Too often, coaches give us their solution. And the question is their solution the best solution for me and for all players? And this cookie cutter method of saying we all need to do a layup this way, we all need to run the offense this way and run it exactly this way. Well, what happens to my independence? And the goal for, I feel, as coaches, if we're really talking about developing performers from the youth level on up, is to be able to develop independent performers and independent learners. And to me, that's the whole thing I come back to. My number one goal, forget about all the science, forget about all the other stuff. I want to create not a practice environment. I want to create a learning environment. And the emphasis is on learning. If you ask my daughter, okay, what's 2 + 2, equals 4? Of course. Well, sure. That's easy. But the game isn't that easy. right? You can't just say, okay, it's always 2 + 4 or 2 + 2 and it equals 4. It doesn't in the game because there's all these random variables, especially the opponent, clearly in these invasion type sports, but also your teammates. Your teammates don't always do exactly what they're supposed to do as well. So we need to create an environment that's representative of the game so that we can develop our individual players and our team. And ultimately, that's my goal as a coach, to be able to help my individual players get better and to help our team succeed.
Yeah. And I think that also takes a lot of pressure off you actually as a coach, I think, because then you're not the guy or the woman that needs to know everything.
Well, yeah, and I can still know everything, but you're absolutely right. Like, again, practice is not a coaching clinic. Practice is about the players and what information do they actually need to be able to succeed and, again, individually perform and help the team succeed. And it's not as much as we think. And the more time, and I say this all the time, maximizing time on task or active learning time, that basically means that you and I, we all learn basketball by playing basketball, right? So if we're not spending time in practice playing basketball, then they're not getting better at basketball. So to be able to maximize their time on tasks and their amount, the amount of time they spend physically engaged in practicing basketball, that's my goal for practice. And to me, that has to be representative of the game, meaning there's decisions. At no point, if I pass the ball to Dom in a game as his teammate, at no point does he shoot the ball, dribble the ball, or pass the ball without it being preceded by perception, decision, and skill execution. Those things happen before the skill. I know you're excited, Dom.
This is exactly what I wanted to get to, because I'm sitting here and I'm, you know, if you do a one-on-one practice, yeah, and you always tell a player how to do a certain skill, then we miss something that's exactly what you were just saying. Because usually, initially, you as a player, first of all, you perceive the situation. After your perception, you make a decision, and then you execute the skill. And then sometimes you get feedback. Sometimes, I think most of the time.
Yeah, you get feedback on what happened,
Yeah, exactly. And that's something I think we don't think enough about.
Yeah, we spend too much time just spending time on the skill, right? And then we expect them to be able to apply it. And that's just, again, it's just not the way it is. It's just not any technique developed in isolation. If we want to talk about dribbling skill, any technique developed in isolation needs to be relearned in context. And the context is how they apply it. So why separate them? Well, sometimes you should separate them because sometimes it makes it easier to understand the skill part of it if you're trying to develop, say, a specific dribble move. But to me, I'm not whole, part, whole. I'm not, you know, part, whole, part. I mean, I am whole, 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 part only if we need it. And that to me simplifies back to what Leonard said earlier. That simplifies the process for me. We're going to start with the game and then we're going to really figure out what each individual or what our team needs to be able to help them play better basketball.
So, as I said in the pre-show, you are consulting a lot of coaches implementing this into their team, organization, or whatever. And I think I already asked Alex this too, but I find it really interesting. Like, what are the obstacles or the problems that coaches usually come across while implementing this?
Well, the biggest obstacle for all of us as human beings, but especially for, I would say, coaches in general is, well, I've always done it this way, right? It's these, you know, cultural or historical norms that we've always followed. Joe Mazzulla is a great example. Joe spent a lot of time with us in our community. He's dove into a lot of the research. So I can speak about this with him as an example.
Sorry for interrupting. Yeah. This is the head coach of the Boston Celtics. Huh?
Yes, I should have said that. Joe Mazzulla had...
Yeah, for anybody that doesn't know.
Yeah. Great one. But the big thing is there's a lot of criticism of Joe from the media, for example. And a lot of them are criticizing him because he's doing something different than the norm. And if you go outside the norm, then again, often, you know, you're considered divergent, and that's not always considered positive. And I don't necessarily understand that. If we look at artificial intelligence and the rise of AI, and every day there's some new thing coming out, And it's like all of us are geeking out and excited about it because it's making our life better. It's making it easier. But meanwhile, coaching is supposed to stay the same way it was 30 years ago. That to me makes no sense. Mm. So removing that barrier is the first step to work with any type of coaching client. And I will be honest, at this point, it's a little bit easier because very few coaching clients who work with us don't at this point already know what we stand for and who we are. So a certain extent, it's a little bit easier. But then within it, I would say the other thing I spend a lot of time on is marrying the concepts for them. Like Alex would want you, and I agree with him, Alex would want to a certain extent all of us to go full ecological dynamics. That means we're essentially putting players in a situation and they're figuring it out because we're creating these situations and it's naturally happening for them through this problem solving process. To me, a lot of coaches can't go there right away. They just can't. So we have to marry that concept. We have to blend a little bit of the ecological dynamic approach with what they've traditionally done so that they, again, the information is dripped to them rather than, you know, a full waterfall. Because the waterfall causes them discomfort, especially as you said already, reference pressure. They make money. They want to keep making money. I don't blame them. So, you know, going full on in is a challenge. But I would say by and large, the coaches from the NBA on down to the youth level that get to the point of consulting with us, they're excited and they're all in to be able to kind of just continually ask themselves, is there a better way? We are not trying to tell anyone they're wrong. And nobody here is wrong. We're just trying to constantly ask the question, is there a better way?
Yeah, it's a very important way of communicating this, I think, also with any change you want. If this is practice or anything else, if you run through the door and put it down with a hammer, people usually tend not to like it and be a little bit aversive, let's say.
Absolutely. And I'll say the other thing is, like, I think it was a conscious approach. We're not here to tell people they're wrong, but we're also not here to create disciples. Like, I don't want anyone to do it exactly the way Chris Oliver or Alex Sarama does it. I mean, we're all unique individuals. We all have our ways and our beliefs and our different things. And I'm not here to change you. I'm here to add to, make over, or in some ways subtract, which I think is often the most important thing, subtract from what you did. One NBA client that I've worked with, one of the biggest takeaways they've said is that it just helped them understand that they could remove some of the fluff. They could remove some of the stuff that was just, why are we doing this? It's not helping our players get better and it's not helping our team win. And an example for that for people in the basketball world would be a drill like three-man weave. Like three-man weave, this dance recital over and over. And I think if you think about any sport, almost every sport has some versions of that type of drill where it's on air, no decisions, repeated over and over. And that's not basketball. That's not how it's played.
If you observe a practice, a basketball practice run by a coach, and if you just observe that coach, are there like any certain, it's non-negotiable qualities you look for in a coach while he's like conducting a practice or even maybe during the game?
Well, I mean, you can go simply. I mean, there's so many, obviously, to a certain extent. But, you know, one thing that I would say is an attractor for me with coaches is an open-mindedness, right? A humility, you know, a humility that comes with kind of knowing that you, like, I mean, the coaches I'm around know so much about basketball and coaching and leadership, and they're voracious learners. And I would say that's generally most coaches, especially that get to do it at a full-time level. I mean, I think coaches are great learners. You know, the challenge in that is obviously that if you're continually learning, then you just keep adding stuff to your bucket. So there needs to be this humility to be able to understand that, okay, I need to remove things as much as I need to add things in terms of those things. And then I'd say kind of the second part of it is, I really do feel this way. Again, forget about anything else we've said about the science, etc. Just think about this. Wasting time is a coaching crime. Wasting time is a coaching crime.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, I agree so much.
The amount of time a coach spends talking or having players run for punishment, or the amount of times players, these complicated drills and all these different things. I mean, time on task basically is how much time are your players engaged in physically playing basketball, right? And that I want to maximize that in every workout, in every practice. I want them for that hour and a half or 2 hours or hour to be playing as much basketball as possible.
That could be a nice stat for a coach, like the ratio of explaining stuff or talking and actually doing stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's such a thing. And coach can track this, and I've tracked it at the highest levels, and some really high-level coaches I've been to, famous coaches, basketball coaches at least. And, you know, I've seen in a 10-minute drill a player being active for, like, less than 30 seconds. So meaning for most of that drill, they were not active. That could be because, you know, there was too many people in a line. That could be because they made players run for every time their pinky was out of place. You know, all these finite technical details that, again, at the end of the day, how much do they matter? And that's the other thing. And then I just challenge you and all your audience to think about too, like, what technique do they actually need to be able to play the game? To me, the decision is more important than the skill, and we need to spend more time on the decision. Think about that at the youth level for basketball. If I could just get all my players to shoot open shots, if that's the first thing I taught them, what is an open shot? In range, in rhythm for them, shoot it. Who cares if it goes in or not? Who cares if it goes in? Like, forget about winning. It's about development. But if I can teach players, the first thing I can teach them is to shoot an open shot, aren't they going to be more inspired to work on shooting? Aren't they going to be more inspired to want to develop their skill of making that open shot? And to me, we start with the skill of shooting, and then we say, okay, now go shoot. Well, how about inspire them?
Yeah. That's how they learn a lot more effective, absolutely.
In regards to this, we had in one of our previous episodes, we had a skill development coach on the show, and he said nothing helps better than makes.
Nothing.
So this...
You know, confidence.
Do you agree with that?
Yes. So confidence is an interesting thing. I mean, confidence comes from proven results, obviously. So my ability to make a shot builds my confidence. But the other part of it is confidence comes from skill. Look, and again, skill is a decision as much as it's biomechanical. So to me, there's nothing. Anytime a parent comes to me and says, "How do I help my son or daughter get more confident?" I tell them automatically, they got to get more skilled. I've never seen a highly skilled athlete not be confident, right? Sure, they lose confidence and that ebbs and flows, but overall they're confident because they have the skills. And to me, this is at the foundation of kind of a lot of what I share too, is the difference between coach-led development and player-led development. The value for all of us as coaches is that for that hour and a half, 2 hours in practices, I can better connect skills and decisions for them than they can. So I want to put them in representative learning environments where they get to connect skills and decisions that they would use in a game. But in terms of the player's development, they got to lead themselves. There's no successful player that did not lead themselves in some way. Meaning, I'm not anti on-air repetitions. I'm not on-air block shooting, say shoot from the same spot over and over again. I'm anti that's my time as a coach. That's their time as a player. And sure, I can create that environment. I can foster that environment for them to do it on their own. But by and large, as good as my daughters are going to be at basketball is going to be determined by how much time they spend on their own with the basketball getting better. Because in practice, we're going to spend all of our time connecting skills and decisions.
Yeah, that's something we also talked about last episode. I think if you start talking to a player, explaining him that if he always takes... I don't know, if he has his routine that he does all the time where he has five spots and he shoots from these five spots as long as he makes 10, that this is not really representative to what he is going to face in the game. And if you then further talk to the player and tell him, hey, if I throw you the pass and if I throw it, you know, to your right shoulder, to your left shoulder, if I throw it like towards your feet, this is probably a little bit more representative of what you're going to face in the game, because the game also does not include that you will receive the perfect pass in your hands. So what do you want to work on? Do you rather want to,
And that's differential learning. And Alex probably talked about that with you guys, just this concept of, and I really kind of phrase it as this, is what you're talking about is being adaptable. right? It's like,
yeah, so yeah, exactly.
Why have I never taught? My daughter now is 12, and my daughters are 12 and 10. But when they were, say, 8 and 10, I've never taught them proper footwork for a lap, what we would deem as proper footwork for a lap. On the right side, this footwork. On the left side, this footwork. Because I think about it, as soon as I teach them this specific technical detail, then that's what they'll do. To me, that's limiting rather than affording them the opportunity to be able to explore and solve problems on their own. And now I would say my daughter rarely ever does a proper layup, but she can score layups and she can finish layups and she's creative with her problem solving because we haven't forced her with this very explicit information to be able to do exactly this way all the time.
So saying that, what I think, and also maybe in going back to the objectives of coaches, for me personally, I imagine this being an objective. If I let them develop it their own, they're going to make mistakes. And I probably feel it, or for me, it would be hard as a coach. And in general, it might be, what if the players head in the, let's say, non-optimal direction in developing the skill? And sometimes there is just a more optimal way.
So, but what is optimal, I guess? That's so individual, right? What is optimal? So I get it.
Yes.
Like, I get it from those coaches that think that way. We must teach a jump stop and a pivot in this exact way, and it must be done in this way. So what we would say is we're not anti-teaching the jump stop. We're not anti-teaching the pivot. But all we're going to do is create the game situation where they have to do it and explore the possibilities. And yes, they will struggle. They will have to fight for their learning. But again, we're trying to normalize the learning process. And I think that's one of the big struggles with this old kind of approach, whatever you want to call it, this traditional approach to coaching, is that it doesn't create the mindset of learning and it doesn't create the mindset for perseverance that we want them to have in games. And to me, if we're putting them in a situation where they have to figure it out, yes, we can always intervene. Yes, we can always help them. Yes, we can always go through task simplification. But what we can't do in an on-air dribble, pivot, past your partner type of drill is build the mentality of learning and build the mentality of perseverance and competitiveness and mindset training and all these different things that we know have more to do with success than almost anything else. So that would be another reason why I would challenge coaches to think about, is there a better way? If I put them in more game situations, they are getting more of the psychosocial approach to actually how you play the game. You know, handling mistakes, handling errors, supporting teammates, all the different things that come.
When do you think is that optimal? Well, probably for a player to experience as early as possible, I would say. But I would maybe even go as far, I think you guys in America, the way you set up sports, it's already kind of that way. But here in Germany, you usually go to one club, let's say a basketball club, and you play basketball. And maybe you can find somewhere else that the times add up that you can chip in with soccer or anything else. But more than two is usually pretty difficult. So to me, the way we should, I don't like the teach kids is more the way of learning instead of the sport itself. Because if they know how to learn, what you just described earlier, they will be able to learn any sports. Let's say if you're, I don't know, 11, 12, you go more specific and you say, okay, I want to be more into basketball than anything else. But before that, you just need to learn how to perceive and learn really any type of sport.
Absolutely. I mean, no one taught you how to play tag. Right? You figured it out. And then you started to learn strategies and you started to figure out things on your own. And to me, and I'm approaching this from a parent's perspective. All I've tried to do for my daughters is to constantly put them in situations, not formal structured situations, but informal situations. Say it's at a park. Like, we've been fortunate. We've traveled the world, literally. And we always try and find parks so that they can go explore their movement skills, they can go explore their possibilities. And because of that, I feel that we're developing their overall athletic development, their movement skill profile, all these different things, because we're trying to expose it to them. Okay, today we're gonna go out and we're gonna throw the football. Today and tomorrow we're gonna throw the baseball. Like, we're gonna do different things, because ultimately, whatever sport they end up playing, it all contributes to their success, right? My daughters can catch a basketball much better than other players their age, at least on their team, I don't think because of playing basketball. I think because they've been exposed to different types of sports that cause them to have to come up with other type of solutions. And that's the biggest part about kind of this other, you know, exposing them to other sports. I'll just say the other part about this, like if you think about soccer or football in your country, you know, basketball, some of these different sports that may be popular in Germany in particular, like the best way to retain a player in your sport is to have them have some success on offense is another huge part of my philosophy. I can't tell you how many players, and especially I'm in the girls game a little bit right now, how many girls have been told to not shoot the ball, to run the offense, to defend and rebound, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, and you're surprised they don't want to play anymore? How about as a soccer player, I'm told, okay, you're a defender at 8. And then for the rest of your life, you're a defender? I don't know. Like, I'll be a defender when it, you know, gets to a point where obviously that's my future and I love playing the sport and it keeps me playing. But early on, I mean, we want to expose players as much as possible to the enjoyment of shooting to score, driving to score, passing to score, right? And if it's not about my ego and it's about development, then that's a much easier thing to be able to philosophically approach.
I want to go back to, I think, Dom, it's our third episode maybe, and I have a quote in my mind of Mike Stockton, and he said that youth coaches do saints work. And I think that kind of, if you coach the youth at an early age the right way, it's really saints work, because they can feed off that for a very long time in their life.
Don't be their last coach. I mean, if you're a youth coach, that's your goal. Don't be their last coach in your sport. That's the only measure of your success, not your championships, not all that other stuff. If you have 10 players on your team and those 10 players keep playing basketball or whatever sport you're coaching, man, pat yourself on the back and have an extra drink that night. Yeah.
I like that one. That was my first brain pop, I think, though.
yeah, that was a very, very good one. Leonard, which direction do you want to go?
Wherever you want to go.
Because I just thought about one thing, and I would really like to get your opinion on that. I've been in the professional basketball world now for 9 seasons as a performance coach. And in my first season, it was 14-15, we played a game, like a very, very important game, because we were fighting relegation. And we lost that game at home. And after the game, I was on the hallway and I just overheard like one of our players talking to one of the other players from the other team, because that team just changed their coach like 3 weeks ago or something. And since they changed the coach, they started playing very well and they won 3 in a row. And then I overheard our player talking to this player, and the player from the other team said, "Yeah, I mean, this coach is just awesome. We just all would go through fire for him." And I'm still, you know, this is still something I keep thinking about. What do you think is something, or it's like, I don't know, what can a coach do that one of his players says something like that about him? Do you have any idea? Because I keep looking for answers.
About saying what specifically? Sorry, maybe I missed that. What was the specific?
The player from the other team said that in the past 3 weeks, since the new head coach took over, that all of the guys are ready to go through the fire for that coach.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I missed, is it was the other team. But, you know, coaching is so fickle, isn't it? Like, what do we say about that? To me, I mean, there's so many variables. There's so many variables in a team success that go beyond the coach. And we see it at the professional level. I mean, it's easy to replace the coach relative to other things. So the coach is often the person that, you know, is a scapegoat. But I mean, to me personally, I like the notion of saying, like, I don't have as much control as you think over this. And I don't want as much control as you think I should have over this as well. Because I want to create an inclusive environment where we're all active participants in this. And that's from parents, the director of the club, to players and, you know, to whoever else is involved. And as much as possible to be able to focus on that active participation, that we're all active participants and everyone is on the team. So we're all responsible for this. So if we are having problems, it's not just me, it's us. And that type of mentality to go from that. So to me, like replacing the coach and the team playing better in that example, you know, probably had more to do with the fact that now the players and now the parents or whoever else was involved said, okay, wait a minute. There's no other scapegoat here. We got to do something different.
Yeah. And I think when I think about your question, Dom, if a coach asks that or thinks he have like he has like any type of control over that, I think that's already heading in the wrong direction. Because to me, going through fire, that would be I trust someone. I trust them really, and I think trust comes through trust. If I trust you, you can trust me. But if I don't trust you, you cannot really trust me. So if I don't go through fire for you, you will not do it for me, really, I think. And so I think that plays a role, but like you said, so many other variables, like what kind of culture is in an organization if you just keep subbing head coaches, for example? What does that say to the players? Yeah, this is just some puzzle piece you can just switch out.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, and let me just say to
you,
me add to that. I mean, and people are always fascinated. Like if you ask coaches in America, they'd want to know what coaches in Germany are doing because they think you're doing cooler things than they're doing. Right, to a certain extent. And it goes both ways. It's the same from Germany. You're thinking, oh, the American coaches are doing the better thing.
Absolutely.
But I'll tell you this, after having traveled the world and literally worked around the world, there are good coaches and there are not as good coaches, for sure. I mean, that's just a case. But to say there's no bad coaches. Like, to me, there's no coach that's trying to lose. There's no coach that's trying to have his players screw up. Right? There's no coaches that are doing that. Now, I'm talking like there are definitely evil coaches that are doing stuff that is evil, and that's like criminal or stuff like that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people that are inherently good people. They're not trying to mess up your kid, and they're not trying to mess up the game, and they're not trying to lose. Just the same way I try and get coaches to understand, look, if a player misses a pass or misses a layup, look, yeah, you can get on them. Oh, concentrate more. But also understand, why are they not concentrating? Like, to me, that's probably more to do with practice design or some type of design flaw within what we're doing than it is with what they're doing. But at the end of the day, what we have to constantly understand is players are not trying to miss layups. Players are not trying to miss, you know, passes. So stop coaching them on those things. Oh, we got to make our layups. Oh, we got to catch our passes. Like, if you're giving that type of information to players, then to me, it comes back to the learning environment and what you've created in terms of, you guys said culture, I say learning environment, but that comes back to that. So to me, that comes back to the whole process of what you're trying to create.
Makes me think of my under 12 coach who liked to say, come on, Leonard, make this shot.
Great.
Oh, yeah. Great. Thanks for the reminder.
Great coaching. Great coaching, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like if only I thought to say that. Make your shot. Oh my gosh. I know. So to me, just another part of that is I would love to have a talk with every parent in the world and just say, okay, listen, here's the actual realities of this. I know what you think. And every coach understands you want your son or daughter to be an all-star and you want them to have a great experience. Absolutely. I'm a parent. Of course I do. But here's the realities of all this. And to just share some realities about kind of this process that coaches go through. Because I think Hollywood in particular has done a great disservice to coaching. They portrayed this coaching as this big speech and these things that are totally out of context of the daily repetitions and the practices and all the different things that really go into success. And it's not a big meeting. It's not a big speech. And it's certainly not a big culture speech. You know, everything you do on a daily basis in practice is what forms your culture of your team more than anything else you do.
Maybe let's dive into that a little bit more, the creating a culture, Tripod, because I think that's really the foundation of anything you want to do with the team. And also, you said, or I said in the pre-show, that you put emphasis on enjoyment in practice. And I think that also goes with what type of vibe do you create in the gym when players are coming in? How do they feel? You know, because I know back in the day when I was a young kid and I came into gyms and I just saw sometimes coaches, just the look of their face made me like scared. I don't want to do mistakes. I need to protect. That wasn't like this, oh, awesome, I can play the game I love or something. Sometimes this happens. So what is something that you put maybe emphasis on that coaches ask you about this, how to create this?
Look, this is one of my favorite things to talk about now, I think, because I think it supersedes everything else from a, you know, ecological dynamics, motor learning, all that stuff. I think this is it. Number one, maximizing belonging. Maximizing belonging. Every single one of your players should feel like every day that they belong. Now, with that, look, that doesn't mean we're soft and we don't hold them accountable. To me, hard coaching is holding them accountable to what you teach because it's important for them and it's important for the team. So I have no problem with holding them accountable to what you're doing. But the way that I would do that is through noticing and normalizing. Noticing and normalizing. So I maximize belonging, and I'll take you through that in a second here. Maximize belonging and then notice and normalize. What do I want to notice? I want to notice today that Dom's doing something better today than he did last practice. Or Dom's doing something in the game today that he learned in the last few practices. So I'm noticing that he's improving. I'm noticing that he's doing something better. And we all want to celebrate sport as, okay, you're perfect at something. You're the best at something. Well, how about the process of being really terrible and then getting a little bit better? To me, that's the most important part of this process, is to normalize the fact that you suck before you're okay before you're better before you're good, and you're good before you're great. And if we spent more time on those things, then we would create that environment, that culture that we just talked about where they'd want it. So that's the noticing part. The normalizing part is to normalize the fact that, when we already kind of circled around this, you're going to miss shots. You're going to make mistakes. You're not going to be perfect. That's normal. We got to make that normal. You know what? You're going to get really frustrated sometimes, right? And here's how you cope with it, and teach them coping strategies to be able to handle that. To me, competitiveness is not, again, it's not this kind of over-encompassing thing about winning and losing. Competitiveness is about learning how to manage yourself, cope with your emotions, to be able to continually compete, using that word, because we are fighting through those struggles. And to me, that's competitive, that's mental toughness, and that's the things that come with it. So my practice plan, just give you four things. Forget about any other technical, tactical detail. Here's my practice plan. The first interaction with every player is a non-basketball interaction. Man, I really like your shoes. Oh, those are cool shoes. Did you get new shoes? Man, what'd you do today with your hair? Like, cool, like I love that you put it in a ponytail or something. You know, I can't do that. I'm bald for people that can't see. So it's like, you know, kind of like just having fun and interacting and making it this maximizing belonging beyond just, you know, I care about you as a person, that type of deal. But, you know, I can't wait to coach you. And that's another part about it, is that the second part I would do in a practice is that I would make sure that I communicate with every player that you are okay and you belong. You are okay, you belong. If I could just give you a quick example, Leonard, of course, he's late for practice, and our natural instinct as a coach is going, why are you late? How about if I said, I'm really happy you're here. Why are you late? What a different conversation. You're okay. You're safe. Yeah. But let's talk about it now. Like, that's a different conversation. So that's the second thing, is you are okay. You belong. The third thing is notice progress. And the fourth thing on my practice plan is to play basketball, right? And whatever the sport is, it's to play your sport. And I've seen rugby, I've seen, you know, field hockey, I've seen, you know, handball, I've seen all these other sports. And I just, like, it's shocking to me how little they actually play the sport in practice sometimes. And to me, that's got to be a part of it. So normalize, notice, maximize belonging. And then obviously, as you already referenced, those first interactions are so important. Coaches, you're allowed to smile. You're allowed to have fun, right?
Yeah.
Like, and we... Yeah. I have to say that to players all the time. I have to say, hey, listen, I understand maybe you've been in environments where you're not allowed to smile. You can smile here. Because you know what? We're going to do some things sometimes that are pretty much, what else can you do but smile? Missing a wide open layup. Oh, no, we should go do more layup drills. What? No, you just, sometimes you miss. That's part of it.
And One question regarding noticing and normalizing. So, well, maybe I'll just ask, whatever. Noticing, would you also notice something negative? Or does that then go in the normalizing?
Okay, yes. So, no.
For example.
Yeah, great question. Go ahead if you want to give the example, but
would you notice, like, if somebody is always making the same mistake?
Yeah. Okay, so another part that goes with that is that I believe that at all levels that you coach, one of the first things you should do, and sometimes at youth levels, obviously it's got to be with the parents and the kids, is that we have to have an agreement. And the agreement I want to have with a player is, can I coach you? Well, almost every player will say, yes, you can coach me. But then I want to make sure they understand what that means. And what that means is that I am going to correct you. And look, we consider correction negative because our society is portrayed it as that. Hollywood's portrayed it as that. Correction is negative, but correction is positive. Like, to me, without correction, without feedback, like, we're never going to improve. So to me, we've got to create that normalization of the fact that this cycle of you do something, you get feedback on what happens, whether it's internal feedback or external feedback, and then you either try and do it again or you move on. And that's a big part of all this stuff, which I think is probably one of the biggest things as well I share with coaches, is that often coaches give really good feedback, but then they don't follow that feedback with action. Always follow feedback with action. Meaning when I give feedback to my team, Dom, you know, on this ball screen, you should have rejected the ball screen because your defender jammed you. You could have attacked, you know, off the reject. Okay, well, that's great. But if I don't put Dom in that context again, first of all, I want to create the situation. I want to talk about it in the context. And then I want to follow that feedback with action. Okay, let's play out a ball screen again. And let's go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they see it right away and they can adapt.
Perception, decision, execution. So they're getting the context. And I think too often we give summary feedback. Okay, we played 3 trips of the floor in basketball. They come back and then I'm talking about something that happened on the first trip. I encourage coaches, and I am this way, the games approach or game sense and these different words that I learned 25 years ago in terms of how we coach, is that I'm coaching them while they're playing the game. Now, we have an agreement that I can coach you. So this isn't just scrimmage, roll at the ball. This is, we're going to create a situation, 5-on-5, play at a wing ball screen. Defense, you have these 2 possibilities. Offense, you can play free. You can do whatever you want. And then from there, if I see something I need to intervene, I'll say, hold the ball, recreate the situation. And then I'll talk about it, or mainly I'll ask questions. Hey, what did you see here? Why did you do this? What might be another thought? And then, okay, let's play from there. Okay, go, play. So we're playing, but they're also getting coached while they play. So hopefully that better connects the information for them, and then obviously better connects the skills and decision.
How much of a practice do you have, let's say, pre-planned? And how much are you just going with the flow?
So that is such a great question. So I would say, every practice I go into, and again, your last practice or your last game gives you all the information you need to be able to develop your practice plan for the next game. So off of that last practice or last game, I say, okay, we need to do this, this, and this to be able to get better. And then from there, I'll simply create those situations and I'll create that on the practice plan. Okay, we're going to play, maybe it's a small-sided game. We'll play 3-on-3 wing ball screen, or we'll play 5-on-5 wing ball screen because we want to connect the hole. And then from there, we'll play. But I give myself freedom and permission to be able to pivot if needed. Maybe, again, they're having a real hard time with, say, the footwork or the dribble move that is required to reject the ball screen, as we talked about in that example. So maybe we say, okay, everyone get a ball. Let me show you this. Okay, go to a basket, on air, work on, take a high dribble, reject the ball screen, attack baseline, score. We do that for like 2 minutes. Okay, everyone balls away, come back. All right, and then we're back into 5-on-5. To me, I call that a reconnection. I am reconnecting something for them that they aren't getting in the context of the 5-on-5 or in the game. And then I simplify it, but then I always bring it back to the game. And I think that's another challenge, is that we do these great drills or these great breakdowns, but then we don't put it in the situation where they need to do it. So to answer your question, it's planned, but it's very flexible. And I want to be free. Just want to, just like ultimately, I want a player to be free to be able to come up with their own solutions. I want to problem solve in practice. And to me, that's one of the gifts of being human. I love problem solving. And I tell you, I mean, I don't know how many in your days, but I'm sure it's as many as mine. There's hundreds of things to problem solve in a day. And isn't that the fun day when you get a chance to kind of really try and figure some things out? Not just in basketball, but in life. Like, how do I open this jar that stubbornly won't open? You know, I'll get the elastic, I'll heat it up, like these different things. And man, isn't it cool when you come up with a solution? That's what players love. That's what young people love, especially. They love to come up with solutions and to have us co-create a solution.
Yeah, that's also something that I always come across with. And I really like what you just said, that you should have a plan, but you should also be able to throw that plan or parts of this plan overboard because something comes up and you just got to be ready and you just got to be flexible.
Absolutely. I mean, again, we don't know. And that's why I encourage so many coaches to start with dessert. And dessert, I mean, is playing the game. Like, don't go into practice and have all this build up to playing the game. Start with the game, because the game will show the players and it'll show us what we need to do more of within that practice. And almost always, like certainly with my college team and with my youth team, we start with playing basketball, 5-on-5. You know, I'll tell you exactly how my daughter's under 11 team starts practice. And this is before the formal start of practice. If there's one player in the gym, that one player is doing something on their own. As soon as another player comes in the gym, they're playing 1-on-1. As soon as another player comes in the gym, 2-on-1. Or 1-on-2, and then it becomes 2-on-2, 3, and it just gradually builds up till they're playing basketball, and then we're going to start practice. We don't need to warm up decision making, right? We don't need a warm up for decision making. And to be truthful, kids don't need a warm up to play basketball. They could play basketball, and you know, we want to maximize the amount of time they play. So that's a part of that philosophy.
Do you see any? We talked a lot about practice now, but as a head coach, obviously you are also in-game coaching. Maybe let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I know the approach is not totally going to change, obviously, but is there any type of change in your coaching in games versus practice?
Okay, so ideally, yes. Right? Ideally, yes. Ideally, in a game, it's the opportunity for the players to play free and independent of the coach. Just by nature of the game, almost all games, when it's an official game, we can't stop it as much, right? We can't give them the answers. We can't give them the solutions. But then why do we practice with so many times where we stop it and give them all the solutions, right? Now, early in the season, as you're trying to develop your habits or your principles of play or whatever it may be, sure, I'm going to hold them accountable to those things and I'm going to stop it more. But as the season goes on, I need to stop it less because that's how the game's played. And if I want them to be able to transfer and connect the information from practice to a game, then I've got to replicate that somewhat in practice. So I would definitely stop it less. And by nature, FIBA basketball rules in particular, they create that environment much better than the U.S., especially the High School Federation or AAU rules, because a shot clock by nature speeds up the number of possessions. So it removes the coach and it gives more decision-making opportunities for players. And the timeout rule doesn't allow a coach to control the game to a certain amount by asking so many times or by solving so many problems for players. They got to figure things out. And that's coming back to Joe Mazzulla, the Boston Celtics. Like, how many people are criticizing, oh, he didn't call a timeout here?
Really?
I mean, he's coaching at any time. He's coaching 5 of the best, 300 players in the world at basketball, and he needs to spoon feed them information at every point. Or aren't the players probably going to figure it out? And I would say, generally, more often than not, that's probably part of it. But you know, that's really hard to do because that goes against all what media or others might suggest is the way it's supposed to be done.
Yeah. What do you say in timeouts when you call the timeout in a game?
So there,
or like, how does how do they look?
Okay, so let's say it's a 60-second timeout. Players come off the floor for the first 15 to 20 seconds. I'm not even engaging with them. Like, that's their time. I mean, a part of the idea of a timeout is a mental break. I don't think it's a physical break, and I think we think about it as a physical break. And yeah, sure, there's a bit of a physical break, you know, in terms of that, but I think it's more of a mental break where there's just this moment to be able to drop focus. And I say this all the time, and this applies to drills. If you want players to concentrate more, teach them when they don't have to concentrate. Teach them when they don't have to concentrate. Don't spend all your time telling them they need to concentrate because you can't concentrate 100% of the time. You and I know that. We can't concentrate. So in a drill, I will literally tell players, okay, if you're the second player in line or the third player in line, you can stare at the wall. You don't have to pay attention. But as soon as you become the first player in line, now it's time to focus in on what's happening. Same for players in a timeout. The first 15 to 20 seconds is their time. You know, whatever they want, laugh about something, sit down, quiet, deep breathe, some of these different coping strategies hopefully we've developed, get your water, etc. Then I'll come into the timeout and I'll say with a cue the same exact thing every time. Okay, listen up. Okay, listen up. So I'll teach players that that's the cue to be able to focus in. And then the goal is, as we know, we're humans, we can't take in that much amount of information. So the goal is to be able to give them one, maybe two actionable things. Okay? Like if I start to just go verbal diarrhea, then I know that's it. And that's hard too for coaches because we feel like if anybody recorded a timeout where you weren't talking the whole time, you know, someone would criticize you. Oh, you're not coaching. And that's, again, that's our perception of coaching is that you got to be talking. Well, you know what's a great perception of coaching? Not talking, right? Not talking. And you know what? Hey, let's readjust this angle on this ball screen. Okay. Okay, what do I have to say in the timeout? And I'll actually make light of this with players, like kind of so they know that I'm not going to go into timeouts. I'll prepare them for this. I'm not going to go into timeouts and say, we got to rebound the ball. We got to get back on defense. We've got to – wait. Don't we always have to do that? Like, if I have to remind, like what do we got to catch the ball. We got to score a layup. Like, no, I'm not going to cover.
Make shots.
Yeah, like, you don't need to cover the things that they should be doing. You know, sometimes there's reminders and there's cues or different things like that. But, you know, and we know that. Like, culturally, if I've got to coach effort, then that's a problem. You know, but those type of things. So more it's about belief, more it's about understanding and different things around that. It's not about effort. It's saying the other team's on a run and we just say, hey, listen, you know, they've scored six straight points. We can change this, right? It's that self-efficacy, that's belief in ourselves or in our coach and saying, and here's how we're going to change it and be very specific with that.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. I really like that because right now I'm watching a lot of EuroLeague basketball. I really enjoy that. And they like to show sometimes the timeouts. And watching Fenerbahce with Itudis, I'm a fan of his way of coaching, I think. He also gives sometimes just time to players and sometimes he doesn't even talk. And you hear players pitching in and bringing in ideas and sometimes even discussing with him or he listens to them and then adds something to it. And I really think that lets you see deeply in how this culture and how the relationships in this team.
Great point there. It's a relationship, you know, and even at the youngest level, don't be afraid to ask a question. Okay, so they're on a 6-0 run. What can we do differently? Like we're all in this. This isn't just me that I'm not actually playing. So what can we do better? And usually, again, if it's an answer coming from the players or from the collective or from the group, then obviously that inspires us more than anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's also one thing that the head coach from the Boston Celtics said. I think it was in game 5. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, he said something like, guys, we can still, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you heard, must have heard it too. Guys, we can bring the, or we can still bring our level of defense up to two higher levels or something like this. And that's exactly what they did afterwards. That was kind of like, I really liked it. Again, these are not the exact words that he used.
No, you're paraphrasing, but I agree. Yeah, that's what he said. He said, we can do better. He just basically said, we can do better, and you know we can do better, so let's do better. You know, I mean, people get obsessed with coaching adjustments, I think at all, especially professional sports level. But you know what the best coaching adjustment is? Do it better. Do it better. You know, like, do we have to change the ball screen defense, or do we just need to do it better? You know, sometimes you have to change it, because sometimes change inspires obviously a different reaction from your players or from your opponent. But mainly, most of it is about, we believe in what we're doing. Let's just do it better. You know, and the other, like, we don't give enough credit to the opponent too, right? Like, the opponent's generally trying to do something to not help us. So let's give some credit there and just say, okay, you know, they did something really well. Now let's counter it and do something better.
Dom, do you have any further questions up your sleeve?
No, I mean,
otherwise I would maybe dive. I give Chris Oliver, coach, sorry, the chance to talk about basketball immersion a little bit, because I think we have a lot of, or maybe one question before that, since I know we have a lot of performance coaches listening. Do you also have other people coming to you to consult with you, let's say a performance coach or other sports?
So, yes, I am so grateful. That's something that's really been a blessing to be a part of, in terms of, you know, I would say just generally the community that we've created is non-exclusive. I mean, from lacrosse coaches to business people, to people looking at teachers, to people looking at things and going, how can I create this learning environment? How can I create this environment where, you know, people have freedom and permission to be able to kind of reach beyond themselves and be the best version of themselves? So I would say those things are not, you know, exclusive to basketball coaches. And certainly from the performance perspective, Jamie Smith, he did a podcast with us, and we created a product together, basketballathleticdevelopment.com, where he did basically applied a lot of these environmental things that we talked about to be able to apply it to. He actually worked with Alex Rama's team for a little bit at College Prep Basket in Italy. So working with a, you know, what would be a traditional strength and conditioning coach who's approaching things from ecological dynamics has been really fun. But, you know, to me, it's been, again, business people. Like, it's been really awesome to be around kind of people that are just thinking and really just asking themselves constantly, is there a better way? And I don't know, maybe your way is not better, but let's talk about it and let's see. And it's been awesome to be around it. And just conversations like this are, you know, it's such a blessing to have these conversations, because, again, it'll stimulate all three of us and hopefully everyone that listens to again, say, okay, let me think about that. All right. And now make a decision about whether that applies to me or not. And then if I can get there or not, you know, all these different things. So a big part of it. But yeah, grateful. In terms of basketball immersion, basketballimmersion.com, I encourage everyone to go there. The basketball podcast is, you know, as you mentioned, 260 plus episodes in. And I'm so grateful for so many coaches who are just willing to share openly. And I think that's been the best part about that podcast, is that we have real coaching conversations where coaches are authentically sharing. And it's not just, you know, talking about how was their recruit, how was the day, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's about them really sharing ideas that have helped other coaches, and that's been great. And then immersionvideos.com is another place where we share information. But any coaches interested in joining the community, if you listen to this podcast, connect with me on Twitter at @bballimmersion and DM me, and we'll get you started in the community and provide a special promo code for you because you listen to this podcast. So, if you're not on, awesome. If you're not on Twitter, then go on Instagram, and Coach B-Ball Immersion is my handle there, and feel free to reach out.
Absolutely, I'll put the links in the description of this episode, and I think that leaves us with really the last, very last question, and this question also put you here, since we also asked Alex Rama. And we always ask our guests if they want to nominate somebody to be on this podcast and talk to us, and have stimulate us, like you said, and have some brain pops. And he actually nominated you. Maybe you have somebody in mind that you could connect us with.
So, yes, Debbie Peterson, who is someone who's been involved with us at Basketball Immersion for a long time, and I'll send you your information. But together with her, we started something that's been a project of mine for about 15 years, and she's gone ahead and started it, and she's running it and doing a great job with it. It's called practiceevaluations.com. And what she's doing is that she's putting a lot of this information that I shared with you in a platform where a coach can upload a practice and have it evaluated. And I don't mean evaluated in terms of right or wrong, but where it's a peer evaluation, where you can get feedback on your practices to be able to say, you know, how do we improve your coaching? Well, the easiest way and the best way to improve your coaching is to evaluate a practice, because I think most things shine through in a practice. So Debbie's created this this tool for coaches that is just this wonderful thing that empowers coaches, a personal way to be able to analyze your coaching. And for those of us that want to enhance their coaching methods and increase their confidence, this is the platform for you. So Debbie would be a great guest, and you can spend a lot of time talking with her about this or that, this concept of, okay, well, we used to do three-man weave, so what do we do instead? Or we used to do this cone dribbling drill in football, what do we do now? These this or that type of things, and go, is there a better way?
Awesome. Cool.
Sounds interesting.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. We'll reach out to her. And yeah, anything you want to say before you leave?
Nope, just thank you for having me as a guest. Thank you for sharing your knowledge with the world. It's just a wonderful time to be alive with so many people like yourselves sharing things and stimulating our thinking. So thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time.
And here we are in the after show of episode 57 with Chris Oliver. And yeah, Dom, I got to start with my takeaway, or one of my takeaway messages, because I have to take back, or not maybe not take back, but reduce a little bit something I said two episodes ago, that head coaches are overrated. No, they have a very difficult and very important job. And I think that came across very nicely today, how much you can influence, but by not doing so much or not doing too much. Maybe that's what I was saying two episodes ago, that coaches are maybe doing too much sometimes. And I really liked that at the start of the talk with Chris, where we looked at the ratio of talking time of a coach and actually, let's call it action playing time during practice. And that's something I have to add and have to get right off my chest at the beginning of this after show.
Yeah, I would like to compliment that, because during the episode, I was thinking that, like he said, there in coaching, there are so many variables. And that holds true. I think sometimes if you look from the outside, being a spectator or something, there are just things you can't see because you simply don't know. Sometimes I think we think that we know stuff, but in the end we simply don't, because we are just not, we are not with the team. We don't know what's really going on. And in terms of coaching, even if a coach sometimes doesn't say things, you simply don't know what's going on. Maybe that is exactly what the team needs in that situation. And from the outside, maybe it doesn't look like it. You get my point a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. And it just fits so well with the episode of Alex, where we also said learning is so messy. And I think he repeated that, Chris, too, in this episode. And
yeah.
You don't need this perfectly structured practice where the coach is like at the center of attention and everybody listens to him and da da da. That doesn't have the best effect, the best learning effect for the players. It's going to look messy. And maybe some people, like you said, are going to be like, what the hell is going on there? But that's not what it's about. It's about the players, the team, and how well they can learn and adapt to their environment.
Exactly.
It's maybe sometimes less is more. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about the learning environment.
Exactly. And I also like the quote. I think you, I'm not sure if you put it on Instagram, but you wrote it down. Wasting time is a coaching crime. I love that, because I could relate to it as a player so much, because I hate the feeling as a player when you're in the gym and you have the feeling of wasting your time. Because then I can only talk for me personally, but I know from other players, they feel the same way, that you become impatient and that will directly influence your performance on the court because you're impatient, you're not really in the moment anymore, you're focusing on other stuff and yeah, it just influences your performance in such a negative way that I couldn't agree more that this ratio of action time and talking time is very important for coaching.
Yeah, very, very good point. There was also one thing for me that I really liked. I think we have not talked about it yet. I just kept it to myself. he said that hard coaching means keeping players accountable to what you teach. And I think that is so important.
Yeah, because I think you sometimes fall in the trap that the stuff we talk about with Alex and with Chris now, that you think, yeah, players can just do whatever they want and it's free-flowing and blah, 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 and it's just feel good. No. That's not. You do keep them accountable, huh?
Yeah. And it's important, I think. At some point, they need, you know, they need guideline. If they don't get what you want them to do, then, you know, and that what he said then, that's something I also liked, where he said noticing and normalizing. That was also a good, like a brain pop for me. I really liked the words that he chose in order to maybe correct things. I really, that stood out for me.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, sorry.
Then maximizing belonging. That's also something I really liked.
Yeah, but I wanted to add to the point of giving them guidelines. I really liked the example in the beginning of his daughter with the layup. She's going to learn that in her own way. You don't have to teach her directly because in that way, you actually, how did he say it? Like the guidelines pressed her, like didn't unfold her potential, but did the complete opposite in a way. Even though it would be the faster way to learn the layup, but in the end, it wouldn't be good for her potential as a player. And I think you have to sometimes see a little bit or differentiate, obviously, between youth basketball and let's say pros. But we talked about that with Alex too, and there are some differences. But I think it's just very important to have that in the back of your mind as a head coach also in pro sports. And the last thing I took for me, and maybe also a little bit more for kids basketball, youth basketball, but how to teach concentration. And if you want to teach somebody concentration or focus, you need to let them know when they don't need to focus. That made so much sense to me.
And I
think it's especially in the youth, it's something you could really, really use to talk to them and to get a feeling for the group. And I think that will help in youth basketball a lot. But also probably in pro sports, because I had to think about the timeout a little bit, since that is more of a mental break, where I would agree with him. And maybe also there, less is sometimes more.
And then there was one thing, and this is what I did not pick up during the episode, because I don't know, I was probably thinking about asking him something. I'll just read it out. I think it's beautiful. I think it's awesome. Learning skills is not the process of repeating a solution. It is repeating the process of finding a solution.
Yes.
And maybe we just leave it to that.
I like that.
Everybody can just think about that sentence one more time, because I think it's really thought-provoking.
Yeah. Learning skills is not the process of repeating a solution. It is repeating the process of finding a solution. Love that, Dom.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So let's take a bow and say we're not taking as long as a break this time. and hopefully hear you guys or see you in less than 2 weeks or in 2 weeks. But
we'll try everything
in less than 2 weeks.
We'll try everything we can.
Yes. Okay.
Until next time.
Yes. Have a good time. Bye-bye. See you. Bye-bye.